Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, an interview from the archives with the founder of the Granny Basketball League. But first, the new film Sons and Daughters of Thunder tells the story of the highly charged and controversial anti-slavery debates that took place at the Ohio Lane Theological Seminary in Cincinnati in 1834. These were the first public debates about slavery, and they ignited the passion of young abolitionist Harriet Beecher Stowe, who, of course, went on to write Uncle Tom's Cabin in 1852, a very influential novel that many believe helped lay the groundwork for the Civil War. The film will air at the Putnam Museum in Davenport on Saturday, March 16th. That showing is already sold out, but it's also airing again on Sunday, and the film will also be shown on March 23rd in Cincinnati, Ohio, where this episode in history took place. Sons and Daughters of Thunder is the work of Fourth Wall Films based in the Quad Cities, and filmmakers Kelly and Tammy Rundle are here. Kelly and Tammy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
It's good thanks to see for having you again. Us.
Well, it's wonderful to have you back. And in just a moment, we're going to also bring in a guest from Ohio who's kind of a specialist in this period of history. But this is kind of a departure for you. I've talked to you many times about the documentaries that you've made. This is not a documentary. It's a narrative film, although it's based on historical events. Tell me what drew you to telling this piece of history.
It is a departure, and it's tough in a way to make that leap, but because it's history, maybe we thought it was safe to do so. But for a first narrative film, maybe choosing something this complex and with so many people and costumes and locations, maybe that was
a little crazy.
Yeah, but we're known for taking those kinds of risks, I guess. And
well, we became familiar with the story. There was a gentleman who attended one of our Iowa film screenings, and he put the script from this Iowa playwright in our hands. Sons and Daughters of Thunder was written by Iowa playwright Earlene Hawley and assisted by Curtis Heater. And she started this project in 1970. And she kicked it old school when she did her research. She didn't have, you know, the internet or anything like that. She was reading books and researching, and she really did a phenomenal job. It was really a fascinating story, something we had never heard anything about. And we felt it was extremely important to try to preserve this forgotten story.
So the play that was put into your hands, as you mentioned, was written in the 70s. Did you base a lot of the dialogue in the film off of that play?
We did. Initially, the Hawleys hired us to adapt the play to a screenplay. And at that time, I don't think we thought anything more would happen with it necessarily. The idea was it would be adapted, and then we'd see what would happen. We chose to make some changes to the play. Harriet's sister Catherine was a larger character in the play, and so we brought Harriet up in the narrative. In our own research, we discovered that Lane Seminary had one black student, James Bradley, and we had access to a speech that he'd given, and so we inserted him into the narrative. And we made other adjustments just to make it more of a cinematic story.
We included Frederick Douglass, too.
And that's how Earlene came to the subject. She began working on a one-man kind of play, a one-man show about Frederick Douglass, but then in the midst of it discovered this Lane Seminary story that really history has forgotten.
Well, you mentioned that you include Frederick Douglass in the movie, and so we have a little bit, an excerpt from the speech that your actor portraying Frederick Douglass gives about the 4th of July. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Fellow citizens, I'm not wanting in respect for the fathers of this republic. The signers of the Declaration of Independence were brave men, and for the good they did and the principles they contended for, I will unite with you to honor their memory. Pardon me. Allow me to ask, Why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn.
So why did you decide to include this speech? What connection does it have to the Lane Seminary?
Thematically, it's connected. The speech, we have only two short excerpts of the speech, and I'm guessing the organizers of the event weren't necessarily planning on the content that Frederick Douglass provided in that speech. It was a very honest and very forthcoming statement about the status of slavery. This was in the early 1850s when he gave that speech. But we, so we thought it was thematically correct. And also the people who worked in the abolitionist movement all became acquainted with each other. And so Harriet knew Frederick Douglass later on. And when we were in her home this last summer in Connecticut, she had a photograph of him, you know, in her home. And so these people are all part of the same circle of people working to eliminate slavery.
Well, in this period of history, again, you mentioned that it was something you hadn't heard about before reading about your film. I hadn't heard about these anti-slavery debates, so I'm sure it's well known to some people, but certainly was not part of the history that I've learned. Frederick Douglass, on the other hand, is a man that we do all know about. Was that a way to make a connection with history that people are familiar with?
Yes, and the same with bringing Harriet up in the narrative. We thought, well, Catherine was a very accomplished woman in her time and is remembered by history for various reasons, but Harriet is the one that's best known. And in this part of the story, in 1834, she's still Harriet Beecher. She's not yet.
She's in her young 20s, married. Early 20s, right?
Correct, not yet mm-hmm. married to Calvin Stowe. Mm-hmm.
I want to bring somebody else into the conversation who I know was very influential in helping to get this film made. On the line from Ohio, we have amateur historian Chris DeSimio. He is president of the Friends of the Harriet Beecher Stowe House in Cincinnati. Chris, hello.
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today. And, I mean, first, I'm fascinated to learn a little bit more about you. I know that your day job is as a financial advisor and a very well-known one as that, at that. How did you make this connection with this piece of history?
There was a book, pardon me, written by William Miller called Arguing About Slavery. It was a textbook used by one of our daughters when they were in college at Columbia University. William Lee Miller was at the University of Virginia. And in this book, he talked about the Lane debates and Theodore Weld, a name I had heard before but really didn't know much about. And then they showed a picture, engravings of this Lane Theological Seminary, which happens to be just a few miles from where we live in Cincinnati and just a couple miles north of downtown. So if you ever see the Cincinnati skyline, you see the stadiums, it's just up the hill and to the right. And it's a very pleasant walk down the hill to get to downtown, but it's quite arduous to run up there or walk up there, and even more so before the roads were any good. In any event, I read the book, and Weld emerges as this giant in this book. And I kept asking, well, how is it that no one knows who this person is? And in fact, the author of that book, Arguing About Slavery, said that he began to write a book about something completely different. And yet when he stumbled upon this story about how slavery was abolished, he said it grabbed him by the lapels, threw him to the ground, and sat on him and demanded to be written. And so if that was good enough for the author of that book, it was good enough for me. One thing led to another. It turns out that when I went to see these buildings where the seminary was, all that was left was a plaque. The seminary itself had been torn apart, mostly in the 1950s, though the iconic chapel only lasted about 50 years. It really was demolished for neglect, kind of connected to the debates. But then also, I'm sitting right down the hall from where Harriet, by then Harriet Beecher Stowe, actually gave birth to her twin daughters, Eliza and Harriet. I'm here at the Harriet Beecher Stowe House, which is also one of the original structures, and I believe the only original remaining structure from the Lane Seminary. So I'm right down the hall from where all that happened. But it's a compelling story, and it spread far and wide. It was in Augusta, Kentucky, about 50 miles from here, that one of Weld's chief lieutenants, James Tomey, lived, and his house is still standing. He's one of the people mentioned in the debates, in the narratives of the debates. And also an interest in women's issues leads to Weld's other lieutenant, Henry Stanton, who also was very active in the debates. Stanton went on to marry Elizabeth Cady. And so this was not just about the abolition of slavery. There was a very strong women's rights movement that was brewing at the same time. So there's something in this story for everybody. And I'm so happy that Tammy and Kelly have made this movie.
Well, and before we dig into the history of these specific debates, tell us just a little bit more about Theodore Weld. I mean, he was one of the architects of the abolitionist movement, but tell me a little bit more about him.
Well, Weld was described as being pathologically modest. He was a brilliant student, and he threw himself wholeheartedly into everything that he became involved with. He studied so hard to become a minister that as a teenager, he was at the Phillips Andover Academy. He literally burned his eyes out. He lost his vision and couldn't see to read anymore. That's how hard he studied. So he went on a speaking tour of the South, teaching memory tricks. And this is where he first became acquainted, you know, personally with slavery. So as a young man, he's traveling around the country, seeing parts of it that someone from Connecticut, where he was from, would not likely be exposed to. His father, of course, was a minister, and he knew the Beecher family growing up. So he was no stranger to Harriet's father, Lyman Beecher, who came to Cincinnati as the president of the Lane Seminary.
And we're going to have to take a short break. We'll find out more about Theodore Weld and about these debates, the first public anti-slavery debates to take place in the United States. They are now the subject of the new film Sons and Daughters of Thunder, a production of Fourth Wall Films. Kelly and Tammy Rundle are here, the filmmakers behind this film, and Chris DeSimio, amateur historian, and he's also president of the Friends of the Harriet Beecher Stowe House in Cincinnati. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about the new film, Sons and Daughters of Thunder. It tells the story of the highly charged and controversial anti-slavery debates that took place at the Ohio Lane Theological Seminary in Cincinnati in 1834. These were the first public debates about slavery and really formed the start of a major abolitionist movement. They also ignited the passion of a young abolitionist, Harriet Beecher, who became Harriet Beecher Stowe, of course, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. The filmmakers behind this production are Kelly and Tammy Rundle of the Quad Cities of Fourth Wall Films. And the movie's going to show this coming weekend at the Putnam Museum in Davenport on Saturday, March 16th. That showing is already sold out, but it's also showing again on the giant screen on the 17th. And it's also going to be shown on March 23rd in Cincinnati, Ohio, where this episode in history took place. Also with us, financial advisor, but amateur historian, Chris DeSimio. He's president of the Friends of the Harriet Beecher Stowe House in Cincinnati. And Chris, just before the break, I was asking you to introduce us a little bit to Theodore Weld, who was so influential in really forming the abolitionist movement in the United States back in the 1830s and 1840s. And I had to interrupt you for a break, but tell me just a little bit more about him before we dig into some of the sound from the film.
Sure, just a little bit more. But just by the way, I'm the past president now of the Friends of the Harriet Beecher Stowe House. After 7 years of being president, I mean, that's too long to be president of anything. I'm just a happy volunteer now.
Oh, wonderful.
But I'll tell it in his own words. Weld, you know, was a natural leader, and here he is. His letters, fortunately, many of them have been preserved, and here he is writing to Charles Finney, who was a famous evangelist, and he's trying to convince Finney to come to Cincinnati because Cincinnati was, at the time, the fastest-growing city in the United States. It was an absolute juggernaut economically, and that's why the seminary was built here, to help kind of, as I said, Christianize the West. This was the West at the time. So Weld is writing to Finney. I'll let you let Weld speak in his own words. He's writing to Finney. He says, "They don't need you at all there in the East. Throughout the West, revivals of any power are almost unknown. This whole region is half a century behind the East. Besides, here is to be the battlefield of the world. Here, Satan's seat is. A mighty effort must be made to dislodge him soon, or the West is undone." That's how he spoke. You can imagine. He just held people. He was spellbinding.
Wow. And let's dig into the history of these specific debates now. I mean, 1834, of course, this is decades before the Civil War, and these were the first public debates about slavery. Chris, I'll let you start. How did they even come about?
Weld was the ringleader. They had wanted him, the faculty had wanted him to become part of the faculty here at Lane Seminary. He had actually been acting as an agent on behalf of the wealthy Tappan brothers, Arthur and Lewis, to look for a place to start a manual labor seminary. Of course, by the time, the topic of the day was slavery. William Lloyd Garrison had already made a stand in the early 1830s in Boston. His influence was spreading. Garrison referred to Weld as the lion-hearted, invincible Weld. Weld and the other students essentially just browbeat the faculty of the Lane Seminary, which was, the president was Lyman Beecher, Harriet's father. One of the other theology professors was Calvin Stowe, whose wife, first wife, Eliza, was Harriet's best friend. And, of course, that's later in the story how she becomes Mrs. Stowe. But the students agitated and lobbied and arranged for these talks, these so-called debates, that was more like a revival meeting. And it was Weld organizing everything behind the scenes, and Weld and his team framed the questions. So you can see the beginning of the drawings of the original architecture of abolition, how it was drawn up and set in motion here. So the debates then took place over those 18 nights in February of 1834 and caused a sensation around the country as news leaked out, because Cincinnati, as they mentioned, as Stanton wrote about afterwards, was just a mile from a slave state. And so to have slaveholders and the children of slaveholders talk about abolishing slavery, which was important. Cincinnati's business was complicit and profited from the slave trade. So it was very controversial. People were here in Cincinnati to make money. They weren't here to abolish slavery, most of them. And so it caused quite a stir both here and throughout the country.
And did this is part of the film. I mean, the trustees of the school were very unsure of whether or not they should have these debates. So what pushed them over the edge?
To have the debates?
Yeah.
It would have to be the force of Weld's personality. He, you know, it was something that, it was the elephant in everyone's room. And these students, who, they weren't just like students as we think of them today. Many of them were, you know, young adults. Weld himself was 32 years old when this happened. Some of them were, you know, doctors and had other careers. They had left their careers to become ministers, and this was the primary focus of their work. They felt that the millennium was, you know, imminent, and that to prepare for the return of for the millennium, that the world's great sins had to be purged, and that included, you know, drinking and breaking the Sabbath, but the main one was slavery.
Kelly, you mentioned a few minutes ago that there was a former slave who was a student at the seminary, James Bradley.
Yes.
And you include him in the film talking about his life, his memory. Do we have any record that he participated in these debates?
That's what we saw in our own research, and that's why we added him to the screenplay. And then the speech that's excerpted in the film is his actual speech. It is an actual speech by James Bradley that he gave on a different occasion, but it was about his experience as a slave. So a lot of what this movie is white people talking about slavery in an abstract way. They may have observed it. They may be the sons of slave owners, but none of them could speak about it from the inside like James Bradley could.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of James Bradley from the film.
I will begin as far back as I can remember. I think I was between 2 and 3 years old when the Soul Destroyers towed me from my mother's arms, somewhere in Africa. They carried me a long distance to a ship, and all the way I looked back and cried. The ship was full of men and women bound by chains. After many long days, we arrived in Charleston, South Carolina. A slaveholder bought me and soon sold me to a Mr. Bradley. He was considered a kind master. And it is true that I was treated better than most slaves. I never suffered for food and was never flogged with the whip. But oh, my soul, I was tormented with kicks and knocks more than I could tell.
That's just a short moment from the film Sons and Daughters of Thunder, the actor portraying James Bradley, a former slave who was a student at the Lane Theological Seminary in Cincinnati, Ohio. And maybe, Chris, you can put this in context for us a little bit. Again, this was 1834, and this was a group of scholars talking about hearing from a former slave, but also talking about the fact that these people who were enslaved are people with feelings and intelligence. I mean, this was revolutionary at that moment in history, wasn't it?
It was indeed revolutionary, and it really helps frame one of the other main currents of thought that was prevalent at the time, namely colonization, because suppose that you were not comfortable with slavery, but you didn't really want to offend anybody, then you could say, well, I'll support colonizationism where we'll buy the freedom for slaves and then send them back to Africa. If it was kind of a, and that's the modern day country of Liberia was started that way. The ironic thing was that the original idea for colonization wasn't so much to purchase the freedom of slaves. It was to send already free blacks back to Africa. And it was William Lloyd Garrison who, before the debates, called it out for the blatant prejudice that underlied the whole foundation of colonization. So the debates were set as, is it better to believe in colonization, or is abolition what's called for? And so by framing it that way, they drew in a much bigger audience.
These debates took place, as you mentioned, over 18 days. And you talked about the stir that they created as the news traveled around the country. Well, news traveled pretty slowly back then. So tell me more about the ripple effect as people learned about what had happened at the Ohio Lane Theological Seminary.
Weld and his colleagues wrote back to their sponsors in the East, to the Tappan brothers, for example. They were already in regular conversation with them, and then William Lloyd Garrison also was publishing as soon as he could. Two of the main lieutenants, I call them lieutenants, I mean they were Weld's associates, James Tomey and Henry B. Stanton, went to New York and spoke at the anniversary of the American Abolition Society's conference. And so it's as close as you have of an eyewitness report of what took place. So by bringing it to a major media center such as New York, it began to spread. Cincinnati had already was getting on the radar screen anyway as a place that was a lightning rod for abolition and the fight against the spread of slavery and the resistance of the slave power. And so, you know, again, you're right. It preceded the telegraph. The railroads hadn't really been invented, but the riverboats, the steamboats in Cincinnati was the main riverboat building and shipping area, and along with the canals, made the news travel faster. So the inventions, the improvements in printing itself, going from the actual old presses to the rotary presses powered by steam. That kind of helped. It was the internet of its day. And so it did take on a life of its own. It was very controversial, especially in the South.
And what were the ramifications? I mean, once news of this reached out, I mean, we know sort of the long-term inspiration and how a lot of the abolitionist movement took strength from it over decades. But the instant ramifications, I guess, as you might call them, at the seminary were pretty difficult. I mean, there was a big question about whether students should be allowed to have these conversations and whose fault it was that they happened, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, after the semester ended, Lyman Beecher, Harriet's father, went back east to do what college presidents still do, which is to raise money. And the trustees, the executive committee of the trustees, met and decided that this was just not good for business, that it reflected poorly on Cincinnati, they believed, they had to put an end to it. And so they passed a series of rules, as you said, forbidding the students to talk in public about abolition, to even talk among themselves. And in fact, one of the requirements was that the students themselves abolish their abolition society. It was just considered to be bad publicity. The college wanted them to stop. And these rules were put into effect later that fall as the next term started. And like any good students, they wouldn't stand for it, and most of them left and went to Oberlin, including James Bradley. Weld was offered a seat at Oberlin's faculty, but turned it down. But James Bradley and James Tomey and most of the other students went to Oberlin and helped it survive.
Wow. And, I mean, I can imagine, since they stayed together, this incident must have galvanized them in their activism.
Yeah, it did. And it led to, if earlier in the program I mentioned how the chapel, if you look at the old engravings, it's a beautiful Greek Revival chapel. It was torn down in 1883 because the college didn't have the money to maintain it. So after the debates, the following year, there were only 5 students left in the theological department of Lane
Wow.
Seminary, and 2 of them were Harriet's brothers, Henry Ward Beecher and Charles.
Well, Kelly and Tammy, I want to ask you, you learned about this history and obviously had this play that gave you a lot of inspiration for the dialogue, but you are documentarians. Why did you decide you wanted to tell this story in this way instead of taking the history and turning it into a documentary?
I think as we developed the screenplay, we just developed a love for the story and for the characters in the story. And like so many of our historical documentaries, you know you're dealing with something in the past, and yet you see the connections to the present so clearly. Obviously, slavery has been abolished in the U.S., but we still are dealing with the after effects of that legacy. And it's obvious, really, when you are seeing the story or reading the story, that some of those issues are still with us. And also it provides a kind of a template for solving any problem that is divisive in nature, and the beginning of trying to solve that problem is just talking about it and being able to talk about it. So it provides a model maybe for that kind of resolution.
When students watch this film, I know all of us, you want all of us to have an understanding of this episode in history, but the question of free speech and whether students should be allowed to have these conversations, I mean, we're seeing a lot of activism among young people. We are seeing controversy over free speech on college campuses, in high schools, in
yep.
junior highs right now. So you've already shown the film to some students, right?
We haven't.
You haven't yet,
But, I'm not an expert on this, but this would have been one of the first examples of this kind of issue coming up. So it begins with emancipation, but it also involves free speech.
Interesting. So there's so many elements that are relevant today. Where do you expect the film to go? Again, it's different from some of your previous work.
Well, we know that it's going to probably be appealing to film festivals. We know that there's interest in broadcast, airing it on PBS stations and whatnot. And, of course, we'll have a national DVD release. And just wherever they people want to see it, we'll be there to show it. We want to spread this story, make people aware of it.
Well,
we have some requests from places that are connected to some of the people in the story.
Yeah.
Well, Kelly and Tammy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
And Chris DeSimio, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Chris DeSimio is an amateur historian and the past president of the Friends of the Harriet Beecher Stowe House in Cincinnati. Kelly and Tammy Rundle are the filmmakers, part of Fourth Wall Films, the filmmakers behind Sons and Daughters of Thunder. It will be shown at the Putnam Museum in Davenport on the big screen on Saturday, March 16th. That showing is sold out, but you can still get tickets to the showing on the 17th on Sunday. It will also be shown on March 23rd in Cincinnati, Ohio, where this episode in history took place. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.